You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
This is a story about goods illegally crossing the border to Canada and where those goods came from and how they came to be in a package at the Calgary airport that was moving. This is a story about turtle smuggling, which is more common than you'd think, probably because you wouldn't think it ever happened at all. But it does, in large numbers. There is demand around the world, including here in Canada, for a particular type of turtle that is prized for its aesthetically pleasing shell. It used to be prized for the soup that you could make from it, but that's a whole different podcast. This podcast is about turtle smuggling and about the man who sent that moving package to Canada and other moving packages to other places across the globe. Why? How big was this smuggling ring? Who wanted these turtles in Canada and for what? And how much exactly are people willing to pay for a baby turtle freshly stolen from a New Jersey marsh? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Dr. Claire Fiesler is a journalist and a fellow at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. She wrote this astounding piece in The Walrus. Hey, Claire.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Nice to be with you.
I'm so glad you were, because this story is, like I said, astounding. It's kind of crazy. Where did you find it?
Oh, these stories kind of find me, to be honest. I don't even know where to begin. I guess it all begins in a dinner party in Washington, D.C. One of my close friends, I live in Washington, D.C., and one of my close friends lives here too. He works for the Department of Justice, and, you know, he knows I'm from New Jersey, and he said, oh, you know, there's this really interesting case going on in New Jersey and turtles. You know, I can't really talk about it because I think it's still under investigation, but you should look into this. They're trafficking turtles out of your home state for Asia. And I just thought to myself, wait, New Jersey? Where I'm from? And that just seemed like this colliding of worlds. And that was in 2018 that conversation happened. And I just started digging from there.
So tell me then about the mysterious package at the airport that started this whole thing.
So in August 2014, there are some staffers, I think they work in customs at the Calgary International Airport, and they're sorting through packages, and all of a sudden one of them starts moving. And the person who described this to me, who's the Director General of Wildlife Enforcement for the Environment, Climate Change Canada, his name is Sheldon Jordan, and Sheldon Jordan described it like this. He said, you know, packages don't move unless it's Harry Potter. And the customs agent opens it up and comes spilling out 11 tiny baby turtles, no larger than a baseball. And there was no food. There was no water. They were bound in this multiple layers of packaging. And when the customs inspector looked at the package closely, he saw that it had come from Pennsylvania and was marked just as a book. And the name on the package was the name Dave Somers. And so right away, they had a sense that things weren't quite right, because these turtles are not from Canada. They're from America. What are they doing here? And this kind of sends off some alarm bells and goes all the way up to Sheldon Jordan, who I just described. He's the director general. And he calls his counterparts in the United States and says, can you look into this name? And then that was 2014. And it wasn't until a couple years later that Dave Somers was arrested and brought into custody for a few different crimes, including poaching. But what's interesting is that, you know, it wasn't just this one guy whose name was on the package. The more I started digging, the more I realized that he was connected indirectly to this other wildlife trafficker who I've been reporting on completely separate. And so I was reporting for the Washington Post on this other man named Kang Zhengto, who was a Chinese national. And I was reporting for the Walrus on this man, Dave Somers. And it was only until like a year into reporting both of these stories that I realized that they were connected.
We're going to get into that investigation in just a minute. But first, tell me about the turtles. What kind of turtles are they? What's special about them?
So, you know, I'm an American, and there are just some things in American culture that just kind of get into your psyche. They kind of exist in the pop culture zeitgeist. And these turtles do as well. They're technically known as Northern Diamondback Terrapins. Mostly people call them terrapins. And they're known, to me at least, as being kind of this icon associated with the Grateful Dead. Are you familiar with the dancing bears of the Grateful Dead?
Right, yes.
Yes, so those turtles that are kind of associated, those are terrapins. The Grateful Dead has an album called Terrapin Station. You know, like everyone else, I grew up listening to all sorts of music, including the Dead. So that's how I knew them from. And then as I got older, you know, they're a mascot here. The University of Maryland has, they're known as the Terrapins.
Right, yeah, that's where I know them from.
Yeah, and so I thought they were like a Maryland thing. I didn't even know they existed in New Jersey, and I'm really embarrassed to admit this because you know I am a marine ecologist. I have a PhD in ecology. The fact that I didn't know that this animal that is you know a threatened species existed in my home state. You know, I grew up at the beach. You know, they live right there in the backwaters, in the salt marshes.
Why do people want them?
That's a great question. Well, they want them nowadays as pets. 100 years ago, they were really sought out for soup, terrapin soup, turtle soup. It was super popular. It was even the favorite meal of a U.S. president. I think it was President Taft.
Mm-hmm.
His favorite meal was turtle soup, which they made from terrapins. But the soup kind of craze of the Gilded Age sent the population plummeting, and the turtles were very scarce for a while. And then when they started rebounding in the 70s, which I talk about in the article, they started appearing on the pet market, and they just became really, really popular. And not just in the States, but they got really popular in Asia. Like so popular that people pay more for a terrapin than, you know, I did for, you know, my Honda CR-V a couple years ago, you know, up to $25,000.
For a pet turtle?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, people will pay up to $25,000 for a pet turtle, which is hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Where was the package going that the Canadian officials noticed?
Yeah, so the package was bound for Saskatchewan. And when I asked about this, you know, why didn't the officials interrogate and bring in the buyer from Saskatchewan? And it turns out, my sense is that buyer was just an ordinary individual who just wanted a pet turtle. I guess 11 pet turtles. But they were completely unaware that they had been wild caught. They were assuming that they were captive raised because that's how Dave Somers advertised online. He duped a lot of his buyers.
Explain the difference between captive raised and wild raised.
Captive raised turtles are turtles that are from captive breeding stock. They are animals that are raised entirely in captivity. They often are very docile. They are fed a diet, mostly, you know, kind of a processed pet food. They won't be carrying diseases, you know, from the wild. They're often protected from that. Animals that are from the wild, that are poached from the wild, they often can carry diseases. They can often be very aggressive. They often have markings, you know, from, you know, just interactions in the wild. And the most important thing here is that, captive bred terrapins, they cost a lot of money to raise and rear. And so they'll often be more expensive. And the ones that are wild caught, the person who's selling them is making a lot of money because they didn't invest all the money into rearing them. And that's why the wild-caught ones are the ones on the black market, because they're the ones you can make the most money off of.
So authorities trace this package back to, as you mentioned, a David Somers. Who is he?
So Dave Somers, he now is retired. He's a grandfather. I found out during my reporting that he is a Little League baseball umpire, really involved in his church. He lives in the suburbs. But for 20 years, he was really well known in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey area for being a really dogged, hard-nosed reporter. He worked for the Trentonian, which is one of the New Jersey's largest newspapers. He started kind of reporting in the tabloid style for a while, but he interviewed celebrities. I mean, wow. When I spoke to him first, when I first went to interview him in 2019, Dave Somers told me that he had interviewed Mike Tyson and Bill Clinton. He loved journalism and that was his main profession. And as a journalist myself, it was so hard for me to understand how he could then enter into this world of poaching and trafficking. Mm-hmm. But I think I've come to understand a little bit more. I've had the opportunity to speak with him a couple times. A lot of that was off the record. He was very cautious, because he's a journalist, to speak with me on the record. But as I got to know him, you know, I really started to understand why he did that. And a lot of that didn't make it into the piece, because it was much more about the larger kind of system and networks of crime. But, you know, I actually have a lot of compassion for him and his situation, which is also might be hard to understand. It's just really complicated why and how people get into this.
How did he do it? What is the actual process for trafficking turtles?
So to understand how you poach and traffic turtles, you need to know a little bit about their biology and their ecology. So if you want to just come with me into the salt marshes of New Jersey for a second, I'll try to make this brief.
Yes, please.
But terrapins are really they're really unique in the turtle world, because they exist in both salt water and fresh water, and they're the only turtle that can do that. And so they live in these areas called salt marshes. Some people know them as estuaries. A lot of people call them swamps, but they're not really swamps. They're these coastal bodies of water that are brackish. So they have salt, it's salt water, not as salty as the ocean, but not fresh either. And they live in these salty environments, and they can, burrow down into the mud. And they spend a lot of their life actually kind of burrowed into the mud. And then the summer times, they kind of come out and they forage on the little fish that live there. It takes them up to 8 years to kind of reach an egg-laying phase. And so that's a signal to us as biologists and ecologists that they live a very long time. We actually don't quite know how long they live. Some people think it's 50 years. Some people think it's over 100 years. I spoke to a zookeeper that claims that these animals are living, well over 100 years. Hmm. We don't even know. But what we do know is that every summer around July, at least in New Jersey, the dates kind of are, fluctuate, whether you're in Massachusetts, which is the northern part of the range, or all the way down in Texas, which is the southern part of the range. But in July, the females come out and they lay eggs kind of on these sandy areas in the marsh, really similar to the way you might see on BBC Nature documentary of sea turtles laying eggs on the beach. And so these animals are coming out, and it's, when they're coming out, they do it at night. When they're digging their eggs, it's kind of, they're doing it very slow. They're turtles after all, right?
Right.
And so if you know enough about where turtles are and the sandy, the good nesting areas and what that looks like, you can actually really easily poach them. And what's interesting about this is that there are certain sites in New Jersey that he poached from, because they're more protected as far as they're away from the human coastal development. They're away from the vacation sites and the tourist sites, which makes up a lot of the New Jersey coastline. Mm-hmm. And when I actually got two emails from readers who were mad at me that I had revealed in my reporting where Dave Somers had poached the turtles, because it's so easy to poach them that they thought that maybe someone would just read the article and go take the turtles themselves.
Huh.
To summarize, you know, these turtles are coming out in July. The females are laying every July these eggs. If you know enough about their biology, you can go find them in July in the middle of the night doing this. And you'll probably come across multiple, or at least you'll find their nests. And then what Dave Somers would do is he would uncover the nests. Often, I think one time an undercover investigator saw him dig over 35 different holes, which they thought were nests that he had uncovered. He would take the eggs out of those holes, which are these kind of like sandy holes in the bank, put those eggs in a bucket. And then in the middle of the night, he would go back into his garage and he would hold those eggs up to a flashlight. And this is called candling, you know, because if you hold an egg, the shell of the egg is so thin that when you hold it up to light, you can actually see the embryo inside. You can check the health of the embryo. You can actually see the embryo move if you work your flashlight just right next to the egg at nighttime. And so you can check that they're, you know, in good shape. And then he would take these eggs and he would kind of rear them in his house, in his basement. And it's fascinating because when investigators went with a search warrant to search his house in 2017, they found over 3,000 turtles in his house.
Wow.
He was rearing in this way of taking these eggs, and then he would sell them online. And he would say online to people that these were captive raised. But the federal prosecutors spent a lot of time following him. I mean, multiple nights, these investigators would camp out next to his house. And there's actually a video. If you go to the Walrus website, there's a video that I was able to get my hands on and provide to the Walrus, which is an actual undercover video of Dave Somers in 2017 candling these turtle eggs in his garage. And so there was just no way that what he was selling online was captive raised. I mean, it was so clear that these were poached. But the problem there for the kind of consumer is that, you know, it is legal. It's highly restricted, but it is legal to purchase turtles that are, you know, terrapin turtles that are captive raised. It's really hard to raise them in captivity. So it's not as, you know, lucrative as just stealing them from the wild and then selling them. And so, you know, something that I was saying to a colleague the other day is the problem here is that there's a legal trade and there's an illegal trade. And one kind of hides the other.
Right.
And that's what makes it really hard to catch these wrongdoers. In the case of Dave Somers, they were able to do it because he was working at such high volumes. But that's really the hard part of this is that, you know, who's to say whether something that sold at like a pet shop was captive raised or not. There's some indications that you can use, but it's hard.
So how then does Somers fit into the big picture? Because this is the last aspect of the story that I want to talk to you about. He's not the only guy doing this. You mentioned already that you've been reporting on somebody else doing this. Is there a network? Is this organized in any way? Or is this just a whole bunch of people who can get their hands on turtles trying to make money?
Yeah. So there is a much larger network. And I'm still reporting on this because here in the United States and in Canada, investigators are still following different leads through this network. And the network is, you know, I think of it very similar to like drug trafficking. You know, there's the person on the corner selling drugs. There's the middleman. And then there are the people who are kind of like the real, you know, ringleaders. So, you know, Somers was a little bit of a middleman here. And there's this other man named Kang Zhengtou who was living in China. He was a medical student, actually, in China, who was purchasing a lot of turtles, not just terrapins, but different types of North American turtles, box turtles, wood turtles. And he never, it's hard. I was never able to uncover evidence that Kang Zhengtou purchased directly from Dave Somers. I do know that they corresponded, and I do know that there was money that went between them, but we were able, the investigators were never able to kind of say beyond the reasonable doubt that that was for turtles. I was able to identify this go-between, a man named Billy Gengeni Jr., who was purchasing turtles from Dave Somers, and then he had been a supplier to Kang Shengtou. But there were also many other suppliers. You know, in my reporting, I've been able to identify, you know, at least 8 to 12 people that that have been found guilty or pled guilty within this ring and piece them together of how they're all connected. But it's really hard. It's really hard to do that. I had to file like Freedom of Information Act requests to the government to try to get some of this information. Some of this information is not publicly available. Some people want to talk. Some people don't want to talk. So Jordan, the thing that is an uphill battle for me is that, you know, I'm trying to piece together this network in the United States, this larger network, much bigger than Somers, that is involved in the taking and the smuggling and the trafficking of our endemic reptiles. But, you know, some people don't take it seriously because it's turtles, you know, it's not ivory, it's not rhinos.
That was going to be my next question, which is, you know, aside from the fact that these turtles maybe not endangered but are at risk, what's the harm here? What is the potential downside?
Yeah. So I guess to answer your question, I'll reference this wonderful article that was published yesterday in Scientific American. And the headline was something like, "To conserve more species, act while their numbers are high." And it was published by another writer, journalist named Michelle Niehaus, and she's written a lot on the natural world and animal conservation. And she wrote it because yesterday just happens to be Lost Species Day, which the point of Lost Species Day is to remember those animals that we've lost, like passenger pigeon, the dodo bird. I can mention so many. But the idea here is that we can't wait till these animals are on the brink to act. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the dangerous time. You know, we need to act before they get in the red. And, you know, we have to be grateful for the species that we have here in the United States. These terrapin turtles are remarkable creatures. I mean, evolutionarily speaking, like, they've been around since the dinosaurs. And they have this tolerance for freshwater and salt water. And they live so long, you know, they live these incredibly long lives. And yes, they're not an elephant, but they are ours and they are here and they should be valued. And I think it's hard for people to remember that and to take them seriously as animals worth protecting because they're thought of as common. Now, I will say, I do think there's a little bit of this fascination that we have in the West for exotic species. And I think that's really dangerous, you know, kind of exoticism. We want to be close to things that are unfamiliar and exotic, mm-hmm. Like elephants, like tigers. But, you know, for people living in Asia, our turtles are exotic. You know, they are unfamiliar. And we forget that. And that is leading to this huge demand. You know, why is it so surprising that to us as Americans and Canadians that someone would pay $24,000 for a terrapin turtle? Well, you know, American and Canadian hunters are paying way more than that to go to Africa and shoot exotic species. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something dangerous here that's larger, that speaks to our fascinations and curiosities and obsessions with things that are exotic. And I think we need to confront that too.
Claire, thank you so much for this. It's a fascinating piece. I can't wait to see what's next.
Yeah. Well, I'll be doing more reporting on this. So there will be more. Don't you worry. And I just want to quickly say that I was so happy to report this story. But the Canadian authorities that helped me report this story were so fantastic. I just want to thank Sheldon Jordan and all the folks at Environment Climate Change Canada that spent a lot of time talking with me, in addition to my sources here in the States. So thanks to them.
That's so nice. Our government officials, not known for their transparency. So I'm glad you got some answers.
You know, I wouldn't, you know, I have a very different opinion. I think there are a few really great government officials that are on the front lines of this work, and they're doing great things, and they know it's important, and they were really willing to talk to journalists to get the story out. And I think, and I commend them for that.
Well, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Claire Fiesler, writing in The Walrus. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. We have no stories other than this one about turtle smuggling. Yet. You can also find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can talk to us anytime via email, thebigstorypodcast, that is all one word, at rci.rogers.com. You can find this podcast in every podcast player. You can tell your friends to listen to the one about the turtle smuggling. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.